spot the difference? Who said that? How long did it take you? How long did it take you to find it?
5 seconds.
5 seconds, okay. So those who haven't heard can still try to find the difference, but there will be other examples. But in on average, it takes more than 30 seconds for people to notice the difference. Especially if this is presented on a smaller screen at a specific viewing distance. Here, obviously, it's bigger, so... Well. Anyway, to color the roof, yes. So, today I want to talk to you about another aspect of the research I do, I've done. And it's quite different from what I talked about yesterday. But it's also signal processing. So, how much have you, for those of you who have taken the, who are taking the image processing course, how much of compression, how much have you talked about compression? A little bit?
We talked about different transforms. Different transforms.
We talked about, yeah. Okay. Talked about this discrete cosine transform, for example.
Yeah. And also the Hard
yes.
transform and Welsch transform and Fourier also.
That's great. That's great. Okay, so there's a few things that I will probably be able to skip or at least spend a bit less time on. But for those of you who have not taken this class or are not taking the class, I will still explain a little bit about the background on compression, because that's what this is about. Looking at image and video coding, and specifically looking at one aspect of our visual system that we can exploit, harness, to achieve better compression of images and videos. And this is change blindness, so that's exactly the spot the difference game. There's only one difference, don't look for 7 or 5 or however many you are used to. In my country, it's more 7, the traditional game, I guess. So, because you can't see the difference immediately, or you know, if it takes you even 5 seconds, if it's in a video, it means that there's a piece of information that is not really important, or we can define importance in different ways, at least. But if you don't see it immediately, it means that we can probably compress that information a little bit more. That's the basic idea here. And inattentional blindness is a slightly different phenomenon, but it has similar, is due to similar mechanisms or similar bottlenecks we have between our visuals, our early vision system, so the eye and the primary visual cortex, and higher processes in our brain, such as attention and memory. So I'll define this, but first I want to give you a little bit of a motivation around coding, compression. So the idea of coding a video, a signal, or any kind of signal, really, is to find a useful representation of that signal. So, for example, a discrete cosine transform or a Fourier transform. And instead of transferring the signal itself, so all the pixels in your image or in your video, you would transfer the Fourier coefficients. And because high frequencies are not really useful, we don't see them, you transfer only the low frequency coefficients. So that's a useful signal representation, because you can transfer only a part of the raw signal if you find the right way to represent it, to split between what's useful and what's not. So the practical objective, of course, is to reduce the volume of data. So for storage, it's not, well, it is a problem, but it's not a major problem nowadays, I guess, unless in some, apart from some industries, but it's mostly for streaming, right, for transferring. If you want to stream a video and you happen to be in a high mountain village and there's very little connection, you have a small bandwidth and you want to use that bandwidth to the best, as good as possible, to and have high quality, as high quality as possible. There are also aspects of energy efficiency here. transferring streaming video is actually quite energy efficient, energy costly. And so if you find a way to reduce the needs for bandwidth, reduce the strain on infrastructure, then it also saves energy and, by extension, the environment. So we have a raw signal, say 1 megabyte of raw signal. It goes through a stage of coding, and that's what we will talk about, and specifically looking at coding with visual perception in mind. And you can separate, well, part of coding, of course, is a transform, is having a right transformation. That transformation will separate the important stuff and the unimportant stuff. Right? So, just a little bit of a quiz here. If I have a video, 720 by 480 pixels, 24-bit color, 30 frames per second, how what's the bandwidth that's required to stream this if it's uncompressed in megabytes per second? Actually, it's just behind me, sorry. So 1 megabyte is either 1,000 kilobytes or 1,024 kilobytes, depending on the norm, I guess. But let's stick with 1,000. It's more intuitive. Yeah. And if you use the 1024 norm, it gives you a little bit less, 29.7 megabytes per second. But the point is, it's a lot, right? I mean, nowadays, well, it's possible. But for that sort of bandwidth, you expect at least HD content, right? Not 720 by 400. And we can probably hope for even 60 frames per second or even more. But you know, if you want to transfer HDTV, so 1080i, so I is interlaced, so you don't even transfer every frame, it's just every other row, and the next frame is every other row but shifted, so it transfers a bit less information. You're probably more used to seeing 1080p, which uses more data. But even if you reduce the vertical resolution by half and you use HDTV format, which is still, well, relatively substandard nowadays, 1080p, well, I guess subjective, but it's, well, 4K, 8K have become much more common. And you need, I would imagine that none of you have this at home, or maybe. Do you have 178 megabytes per second? When I give this talk in New Zealand, no one have it. Internet is pretty slow over there. There's no way, it's a bit faster, but I don't think anyone gets to that speed, right? No. So, in order to watch a video in 8K, 8K or even 4K on YouTube, you need a way to press that stream. And there's a lot of redundancy, spatially, temporally, spectrally as well. You can reduce the chromaticity channel, reduces the resolution by half, and people don't really notice. We have a lower sensitivity to contrast in chromaticity, so we can exploit that as well. And there's a lot of masking effects, and in fact, change blindness and inattentional blindness are specific types of masking effects. Masking means there's a signal and there's a mask, and because we are focusing on the mask, somehow we don't see the signal. So that can be an artifact, a compression artifact that's hidden in a complex texture. Imagine a scene representing a tree or a bush, relatively complex. You can modify a lot of pixels without people noticing that something has happened because you don't encode in your brain, you don't encode every single pixel, you encode the general appearance, the general texture attributes. So, I imagine this motivates the need for compression pretty well. So some compression standards you might have heard about for those of you who do the image processing course. And of course, everybody heard about JPEG, I imagine. But JPEG is only one type of compression. It happens to be very widely used because it's extremely efficient. And all the hardware, in fact, there are even some chips in your phone that are probably dedicated specifically to doing discrete cosine transform, which is the basis of JPEG. I wonder if there probably are some chips out there that do JPEG compression and only that. So it's extremely efficient to do that. But of course, it's not the best you can do in terms of ratio between quality and compression, preservation of quality and compression of data. You have more state-of-the-art models. They're just less used. They have not necessarily been standardized. So JPEG, XR, so these are standardized, of course, but there are many more ways to compress data. So especially in the era of deep learning, finding a useful representation of a signal is relatively easy if you have a lot of data. So DCT is pretty rigid. You assume your signal can be decomposed in terms of sines and cosines. But you can think of other types of signals than sines and cosines. And if you throw a lot of data at a deep learning model and ask the model to compress that as much as possible, using, for example, an hourglass model, autoencoder, where you have a bottleneck, you try to compress all the data there and reconstruct it. And if you have a sufficiently large amount of data and a well-designed model, you can find really, really efficient ways to represent your data that can be up to hundreds or even thousand times more efficient than JPEG. But they are less convenient to use in practice because, very few people use this, and JPEG is still very, very simple, very interpretable, and very easy to use, and lots of hardware have been designed for JPEG. So I think it would still take a few years, maybe even decades, before JPEG starts to give way to something a little bit more tailored to the data, rather than, JPEG is based on DCT. DCT is like a really mathematical tool which we apply to the data. Instead, we could look at the other way around, take the data, find out what's the best representation, and compress accordingly. So JPEG XR is another standard which can be applied to different types of data, including stereo images, for example. JPEG HDR for high dynamic range images, which we talked about in the computer graphics course, at least, images that have more than 8 bits per channel per pixel. JPEG 2000, this one is relatively common, I think. Obviously not as much as JPEG, normal JPEG, but it's same idea except instead of using DCT, which and instead of decomposing your image in blocks of 8x8, and we'll talk more about this after, you effectively do a wavelet decomposition, which is more comprehensive, holistic. Takes the whole image as a block instead of dividing it in small blocks. So if you use JPEG and you compress too much, you will have this block effect. You will see the boundaries between all these 8x8 blocks. JPEG 2000 doesn't really have this. It has all the types of artifacts, though, like you can see here. High frequencies can be removed to an extent, but after a while it produces artifacts. PNG, GIF, these models are, these formats are obviously also quite old. But these do not support lossy compression. So you compress, you decompress, and you obtain exactly the same signal as the one you had at first. In JPEG, you remove high frequency in the process. You can't recover that. But you don't really need it because we don't see it. For video, which can also be used for image because you have typically two regimes, as it's called, the intra regime in video coding, where you encode what's in a frame, and it's typically inspired by a JPEG, so it's always the same. You have a transformation, and then you separate what's useful, what's not. Typically, high frequencies is not useful. And then you have the inter regime in video compression, which is comparing one frame to the next and trying to exploit the fact that there's usually a lot of redundancy between these. But the intra regime can be used for simple video image compression. So standards have been developed. So from H.264, which even like 5 years ago was still the biggest standard. It's pretty widely used today, I guess. But H.265 starts to be a little bit more common. Anybody here download Torrent or whatever? You know, you probably see more and more of H.265, HEVC formats. Much more efficient. So effectively, it's always based on the same principle, these formats, but there's just more complexity that is added, and that is that can be applied in practice because the computational power we have is more and more. We have more computational power, so we can increase the complexity of those codecs. H.266 starts also to be, it's been a few years now in development, or at least it's been used in some industry for a few years now, but it's probably not as widely used for the general public nowadays. But it's just natural extension of HEVC with a little bit more complexity. I'll talk about this. So like I said, these two regimes in video coding, you have intra, which is basically just image compression, and inter, and that's the major difference between image and video compression. You have motion, you have a temporal dimension in a video. So typically what you will transmit, what you will encode, if you will encode the first frame completely, and then the subsequent frames, you will just encode the difference with the first frame. So there is a specific type of distortion that happens when you miss the first frame for some reason. You disconnected from the internet, and you were watching a movie with a pretty long sequence with very little changes, always the same scene, and suddenly all you have is just one part of the scene that keeps moving, and the rest is sort of gray and looking weird. I don't know if you've experienced this. It happens also if you have a slow hard drive that happens to break down from time to time. So if you miss the first frame, then all you have is a gradient, is the difference between. So you would be missing the house, for example. Some artifacts that we are trying to characterize, that's image quality assessment and enhance. So first, let's understand them before trying to enhance them. To avoid them as well, I mean, when I say enhance, I mean also we could look at the workflow for compression and trying to fix what or enhance or improve what can reduce this type of artifacts. I'm assuming you've all seen these before.
Right. Contouring, typically, if you reduce the dynamic range of your data, you will have less and less possibilities to create smooth gradients. And so that's typical if you watch a movie that's been encoded. The scene at night, for example, typically in the dark side of the color gamut, you will have less precision to encode subtle differences, and that leads to this kind of contouring effect. Right? If you had 16-bit data, 16-bit per pixel, per channel, per pixel, you would be able to encode the gradient much more smoothly here. But of course that creates more data. So when you compress, you can end up with loss of smooth gradients like this.
color bleeding, this happens when you process the chromatic channels separately.
Sorry. The one at the top. So typically in JPEG, explain that in a moment, but you will process your chromatic channels differently, especially you will reduce the resolution by a factor of 2 because we are much less sensitive to it. And in doing this, when you bring it back together, you may have some misalignment problem between the
chromatic and achromatic channels. And that can lead to something called color bleeding. The color bleeds away from the edges of the object. Ringing, that's pretty bad looking from where I'm standing, but you can see probably that we have some ringing effect going on around the lines here. That's also due to removing high frequencies. And then we have blocking effect, which is, like I mentioned, because JPEG processes your image blockwise. So if you compress too much, you lose the spatial correlation between those blocks. So you lose the consistency from one block to another, so you have this kind of effect. For videos, what I mentioned earlier, if you have a dropped frame, like you encode the first frame, but if it's dropped, if you miss it somehow, then all you are left with is the difference. So, for example, here we have a scene where we have some clouds moving, but the hill here, or whatever it was, but it seems like it was a hill, was only encoded in the first frame, and in the subsequent frame it was just zeros. But since the clouds are moving, they are encoded in the subsequent frame. So if you miss the first frame, you miss what was static in the scene. Okay, so when it comes to any questions about this, any comments or questions? No. You had already a talk on image quality by Marius, or yeah. So some of the things I'm going to tell you now are probably redundant, but I look at it from a slightly different angle. So Marius would have told you about, I assume, about existing models that try to answer the question, what can we see, and what can we not see, and what we cannot see. If we can clearly separate it from the rest, we can then discard it and achieve higher compression. But when it comes to evaluating the quality of the signal, be it an image or video, 2D, 3D, high dynamic range, whatever you're working with, there are many aspects, not just what can we see, there's also what do we expect to see. It's highly subjective. If you have a pink elephant walking in a room right now, it will be extremely salient because you don't expect this. So it would have to be compressed relatively at relatively low rates. Otherwise, you would have so much attention drawn to it that you would really pick any compression artifact. If, on the contrary, my voice starts losing some of its... if we were online, for example, and my voice started to have more and more noise into it, over the course of two hours, after a while, you just don't pay attention to it anymore, so you don't pay attention to those artifacts. So what you expect to see, what you think you see, what you make of what you think you see, because you can hallucinate things as well. And that's what change blindness is, actually. You expect that there's no major difference. At least when you play the game, sure, you expect there will be a difference, you know, a character with a hat in one picture without a hat in the other. But if you're just looking at a video without expecting these kind of things to happen, we can exploit the fact that we don't see a gradual change and increase the compression rate as the video is played. You don't expect it. Now I'm telling you, so if I show you an example, you will expect it. But you know, that my point is, it plays a major role. It's not just about what the eye and the visual cortex can process. It's about how that information is then conveyed to attention and memory. And there's a huge bottleneck there. Right? There's already a big bottleneck between the eye and the visual cortex. And then everything is encoded in a very efficient way. We'll talk about this. Some image quality metrics. Basic ones, I'm assuming Marius already gave you this example of this mean square error or PSNR that are have been used at the very early stages of image quality assessment, but they do not correspond to perceived quality. MSE, the mean square error, is just you take the difference between every pixel between the original and the distorted image, and then you basically take the average. Square it, and then you take the average of the square of the sum, the square of the differences. But that's just looking at pixel by pixel. We don't do that. Our visual system doesn't work like that. We are sensitive to contrast. We are sensitive to regions, textures, not individual pixels. So this works to an extent, but it correlates very poorly to visual perception. And a good example here is that these three images, they have the same MSE when compared to the original, and same PSNR. But I'm assuming to you as well, they look of different quality. I would say the one on the right looks like it has the best quality of the three. But PSNR, RMSE, or MSE do not capture that. Right? Anybody would disagree with me and pick another one as the best quality? Maybe this one? Subjective. The structural similarity index, Marius probably mentioned this, SSIM, one of the most famous metrics, even though the term metrics is a little bit inappropriate here, because in mathematics, a metric has a certain definition. In image quality, it's not necessarily a metric, it's more like a distance, a measure, divergence measure. Because a metric implies that if you switch X and Y, you obtain the same result. It's not always the case in these metrics. And there are other properties that, for example, SSIM doesn't satisfy. But it's called a metric in the literature. Let's just stick to that term. So it uses three terms, luminance, contrast, and structure. And then it basically calculates them, a small window, and compares the window in the original same window in the distorted image, and it calculates the difference in terms of basically the luminance for the L term is basically looking at the average values. So the mu here is the average within the window. So if the average value in both case, in both image, in both windows is the same, so typically the luminance term will convey that it has a good quality. The contrast is looking at the standard deviation. So if you have a really low standard deviation in one case and really high in the other, then there's a difference in contrast. And the structure is the covariance, or correlation. Well, it's covariance in this case. But if you have an edge on one side, you need to have an edge in the other side. Right? They need to move together. If the edge has disappeared, like it's the case here, you will have a lower covariance. Okay. And the SSIM term is a weighted sum of a weighted product, actually, of these terms, and it's between 0 and 1. If you input two images and it gives you a 0, it means that there is no similarity between them. If it gives you a 1, they are perfectly identical as far as the model can see. It's already calibrated. I mean, if you install it in Python, there's already a number of libraries that implement it, and it's already calibrated on subjective data. But it's simple, but it's limited in what it can do. And of course, there are much, much better models. One of the major drawbacks of this one is that it doesn't work with color. You can apply it on each color channel separately, but we perceive color as a whole, not as a concatenation of three channels. Other metrics that exist, I won't go too much into the detail here. But there are two different paradigms, or three actually. There's a full reference where you actually have the original and the distorted image. In what context do we want to develop a model that can predict the fidelity of an image with respect to reference? I mean, when you walk in the street and you see a big billboard with a print on it or a display on it, you can evaluate the quality of the print or the display, but that would be without reference. You don't know what it originally looked like. But if you have a big, you know, misregistration of chromatic channels, you can see that on newspapers sometimes, the colors are a little bit separated. Or if the picture is printed in a way that looks weird, you will notice that there are some artifacts without having the reference. Right? So that's a no reference case. But there are some cases where it's useful to be able to predict the fidelity. And what kind of cases are we talking about?
If you want to develop a compression algorithm, you want to make sure whatever comes inside, whatever gets in the codec,
is similar perceptually to what's out. So when you design the whole workflow, the codec, you need to be able to compare original and distorted. But if you are only on the decoder side, you don't have access to the original, then you will use no reference because you will just be able to say, okay, that's the pixels I have, what can I do with that? You also have the intermediate case, which is the reduced reference case or partial reference. And that can be used, for example, if you also in a transmission scenario, instead of sending the whole image compressed and the whole uncompressed image, which would defeat the purpose of compressing, you just transfer a few attributes of the original image, like, for example, a histogram of distribution of colors in the original image. And if the distribution of colors in the compressed image, in the decompressed image, matches the original, then to an extent it's working, right? There are other attributes that are a little bit more meaningful than the histogram that allow you to evaluate the quality of an image given just a little bit of information about the original. Okay, and nowadays the bottom line is that deep learning has taken over this field and the best results are achieved by deep learning, but at the expense of interpretability of the model. So there's still a lot of motivation for developing models that can be explained, that are simple, that have a low dimensionality, a few numbers of parameters. Okay, questions? Okay, so let's talk about masking a little bit. Did Marius talk about the just noticeable distortion? Even in if you're taking a course on color science, you would have heard about JND in CLAB color space, the smallest distance between two colors that actually leads to a perceived difference. So in CLAB, for example, it's like 2.3 or something. But it applies also to distortions in general, not just color distortions, but distortion of contrast structure. And so there was a lot of research and still a lot of very open questions around what it is that we can or cannot see. And what is noticeable in terms of distortion. What is the threshold above which we start noticing something? And the reason why we don't notice below it can be simply generally called masking, is that there is something going on that distracts us somehow. It could also be simply the fact that we're not able to see it. Right? There are some things that come into our system and are compressed already, or like color information is encoded in a particular way, and it's possible that there are some color contrasts we just cannot see. It doesn't exist anywhere in the signal processing workflow between our eye and the brain. But there is some information that actually makes its way through our visual system, and at some point, it's just not encoded, or it doesn't reach our consciousness because we are distracted by something else. And that's masking. So there are such things as luminance masking. So if you look at a very bright light, you won't see what's going on around it, for example. Contrast masking. I mentioned this, this picture of a bush or a tree, and there's a lot of textures, a lot of contrast. you can modify that contrast to an extent without people noticing, because again, we don't really pay attention to the single details. We could if we wanted to. So if I drew your attention on something, there's a point above which threshold above which you would notice if your attention were directed to it. Temporal masking, and then this is where the change blindness paradigm comes into play. There's a difference between low-level masking that defines problem of we can't see something simply because our visual system is our early vision system does not capture it. We don't have the right sensor. So even if I drew your attention to it, you wouldn't be able to see it. That's what we refer to as low-level masking. And high-level masking, on the other hand, is like change blindness. You don't notice it until someone points it out. And both are really interesting to explore. The high-level masking is interesting because the reason why you don't see it in the first place is not necessarily that it's not useful, but you didn't deem it useful. So if you're just looking at a video and you're not, if it's not in the medical field, for example, you don't need to extract any sort of capital information from the video. Well, you can probably rely on the fact that you didn't notice and therefore it's not useful. Medical imaging, it's a different story. But that's what we're talking about here, like general media consumption, general free viewing of media. So the just noticeable difference or distortion can be defined in different ways. And according to some definitions, one JND corresponds to 75% probability that an observer would see the difference between two stimuli. Now, of course, in practice, it's more complex because there's no such thing as one observer or standout observer. Everybody's different. Everybody had something different for breakfast. Everybody had something different on their mind, different state of mind, and therefore your ability to draw your attention to certain things will be completely different. There's already differences in how we perceive colors, so if you take into account that and attention and memory, the differences between all of us are starting to be even of a higher magnitude. When it comes to contrast, temporal luminance masking, this sort of low-level masking, typically one way to model this is looking at different scales of your image, looking at different types of texture attributes, orientation, frequency, and trying to find out, for example, in the DCT domain, which frequency band are we the least sensitive to, provided that another frequency band has a lot of energy, for example. The mask would prevent us from seeing certain things. And JND is typically used in perceptual coding, where we try to make the errors less visible. So adding some compression artifacts, or at least trying to be smart in terms of where do we try to place the compression artifact, making sure that if there's a face in the image, people will probably draw their attention to it. Don't compress it too much. But the background, compress it higher because, well, we are more likely to be subject to masking there because we don't draw our attention, because we spend less time trying to figure out what's going on there. Okay? So in video, for example, there is a lot of work around trying to estimate the JND, both in the temporal, spatial, chromatic aspects. And here you can see, for example, in this scene, there are some clearly two distinct regions. There's the stadium, the place where the field where the players play, which is pretty low frequency. If you take this or this cube, for example, it would have relatively low texture energy, but very little texture, very few things going on here. It's just flat green with an edge maybe here, and a ball, but very little texture. Some motion because there's a player playing there. Whereas this block here has much more texture, and that piece of information means that we can compress these blocks more. Also, they happen to be more away from the center of attention, which is typically the ball, right? So that's what this foveation means. It means that if you are looking here, this part here will still be captured in your peripheral vision, but it will be blurred, right? If you can try to play a game with where you show a card to someone, basically a basic card, and you ask them to recognize the color. And if you place it at that angle, the person will see the card and will probably have some confidence to say, yeah, it's an ace of spade or whatever, or it's a red card or black card. But it 50% of the time, I would say, depending on how you do this, of course, but they will be wrong. Because you really don't see what's going on there. You don't see the colors, you don't see the high frequencies. So foveation refers to this effect of looking somewhere, and everything around is increasingly blurry as you move away from the center of the fovea. Okay, so most research, like I said, focused on answering the question, what can we see? But the others are really important as well. That's an example of foveation, where you actually focus on the face and everything else is blurred. Of course, the images are different, but to some extent you preserved the important part of it. There are many models out there to define what is salient, what is not salient. One that was published many, many years ago, which is still very valid in the sense that most models have been inspired by this one, to create saliency map. You input an image, and the output is a map where you have a lot of energy where we are more likely to look at. And it's all based on contrast. Contrast in terms of color, in terms of intensity, or orientation. So these are different types of saliency map. So that's the input, right? This is ground truth, where people have probably drawn on the image. This is what I think is the most important part of it. And these are different algorithms that produce different types of map that tell you where we are more likely to look at. And they will each have their own qualities and drawbacks. But that's used to compress more, you know, where you have less chances to look at. And this is an example of how we can exploit change blindness, or more generally visual awareness or consciousness, conscious perception. Like you, I'm showing you these two images. You know what I'm talking about. You know what the title of this presentation is. So you know what to expect, right? But if I ask you to tell me, okay, these two images have some differences, you probably noticed some of them by now. Which one was the original? And one is the original, you said?
Yeah.
Anyone else? Well, no. That was the other one. But, you know, it's really impossible to say unless you created those images, which I did. So what happened here is that we carved out part of the image that could be reconstructed from the rest of the pixels. And what we carved out, we don't need to transmit. So that's bandwidth saving right there. And the reconstruction, of course, is really important that you do it properly. But it's not, in that case, and I guess that's the point of this whole research, you don't need to recover exactly the same thing as the original. You can go beyond trying to make the error non-noticeable. You can make it noticeable. That's fine. As long as it's hard to say which one is the original, I guess. Or as long as it doesn't disturb you, or it feels normal, natural. And unless we're talking about military applications, medical applications, where you cannot modify the content of the image, but here it doesn't really matter. I'm not going to ask you a very specific question about the nature of the grass in that corner, which happens to be different in those two images. So another example, where, well, you have some clear differences. I can you look at the top right, for example, again, this one is the original and this one is the distorted one or modified one. And actually, some of these artifacts, some of the differences, you wouldn't even notice even if I gave you like a minute. And then I point it out, and you say, oh, yeah, sure, they are there, but doesn't really matter. So this is a motivation for how we can exploit change blindness, or at least the inability to notice immediately a change for image compression. And even if you notice it relatively immediately, the fact that you can't tell the difference, or you can't tell which one is the original, which one is not, means that, well, we can compress without necessarily trying to recover the exact signal that comes out of the visual cortex, which is what other techniques are doing, trying to represent the visual cortex. We can go a little bit further. So, can you see the difference? Up, I'm getting tired of this. Look at the pink character. What is standing on? It's a small difference. Okay, this part here. Right? It's dark green here, and it's light green here. Okay? So, I showed you just another way to induce change blindness. You have the two images next to another. And by moving your eye from one to the next, as you move it, you carry information, but only a limited amount of information. So you have a disruption just by the eye movement. Here, the disruption is simply a blank screen between. If there was no blank screen, like this, it pops out immediately. Bottom-up salience. So imagine, it's a bit like, you have in two buckets and you need to carry water from one well to your kitchen, whatever, and you're moving your eye from one place to another, you can only carry a certain amount of information, a certain amount of water at a time. So you need to pick, what is the most useful, and it turns out that people don't find this particularly useful in interpreting the scene. If I had changed the color of the sky, you would have probably noticed more, especially if it was a bigger difference, pink sky, for example, you would have noticed. I guess I could have removed the sun without people noticing, though. There are some differences that can go unnoticed in a very, very surprising way. And there will be more examples of this, but let's take a short break. define your objects, by the way?
Showed me some other samples, some other printer samples. Those will now be translucent.
From this 3D printer we have?
Yes.
Yeah. So okay, so it is possible to print it out.
I mean, previously he showed me some cubes. It had, it was gloss.
Yeah.
It has some glossy parts and it was also translucent.
Mm.
So I mean, the main body was white and it has just a translucent part over it. So even if I'm taking the measurements from spectrophotometer, I will get wrong values.
Yeah, I understand. But if you can print without translucency?
Yes. So he actually showed me those samples, and I have to make 75. And he said they were also planning to make some different color printed cubes for the lab for other students. So it would be a good plan.
Yeah,
so
no, that sounds like
I mean, if that can be useful for the other students, then it's completely fine. So I just sent him another email that, I mean, I actually mentioned all of these points about the brush stroke, about the price, the time, even I can make mistake making the mixed colors because
yeah,
I have no idea what can be the suitable colors or the perfect colors making for making different shades. So he actually didn't reply, so I just sent this as a forward email. So I mean, I think this will be feasible, and if I get some extra time, I can put that actually in conducting the experiment. So
sounds good. Let's hope he replies quickly and positively.
And I mentioned everything that it will be matte.
Yeah.
And also, it will be possible to even go for 15 shapes or 5 colors. So we only hope if he says yes, then I can just go for it.
It will save you a lot of time. Yeah.
So
okay.
Thank you for your
time. No, of course. Okay, let's continue. So, as I mentioned, the reason why it took you a while to see the difference between these two, apart from the fact that there was a disruption, is because this is really not important, what exact shade of green we have at this particular location in the image, unless someone asks, you know, not really important. But if we are compressing, then that's important. You notice the difference here, right? Even though there's the disruption. Even without comparison, we can see that this is compressed and you have this ringing artifact I was telling you. So that's important stuff, overall quality. So again, the general principle of coding, have your raw signal separate important and unimportant stuff, and that's exactly how our visual system works. We have attention mechanisms to help us understand what's the important stuff, but we also have our visual system was designed or evolved in a way that we focus more on important stuff. We are able to find berries in a bush, for example. That's why we have this red-green color opponency channel. So there's a lot of things that's already embedded. There's a lot of things that's learned. And of course, there's a lot of idiosyncrasy in this, subjectivity. We are all different in terms of what's important and what's not. But the objective of this research is to point out that there are some aspects, some features that can be changed, that you would notice if they are changed, but most people would agree that the change is not really important. Not because it's an unimportant location, but the change itself isn't important. And that can be exploited. Just a little bit of what's happening in our visual cortex. So if you, those of you who have who took a deep learning class, you probably heard about the hierarchical structure of our visual cortex and how deep learning models are inspired by this. You know, building up increasingly complex features, starting with just little lines and blobs, different colors, and then constructing shapes of increasingly complex nature. So we start with V1, the first region of the visual cortex. And then there's V2 and V4. What happened to V3? Well, it's used for something slightly different than object representation. In V1, some features will be indistinguishable from each other. In V2, the same happen, but with the differences between those features would be probably higher level, and higher level. Differences you can and cannot notice will become increasingly abstract as you move inside this so-called ventral stream. It's part of the visual system that is responsible for perception of recognition of objects, perception of shapes, colors, and textures. So, like I said, deep learning models are inspired by this. So that's why this probably looks like a deep model where you extract edges and then you combine them into increasingly complex structures until you have some out of your brain, have some neurons, some groups of neurons that are specifically sensitive to certain faces. You know, when you see one of your friends, you have a particular set of neurons that activate just because of that face, right? So, in order to keep this whole thing efficient, of course, you need to sort of lose information along the way. At some point, you cannot encode everything, and you cannot have a set of neurons dedicated for every single person on Earth. So this is why you have your attention mechanisms, your memory mechanisms, allow you to separate the useful and the unuseful or non-useful stuff. Okay? And this is just an example of low-level features that are extracted by your visual cortex. And a good way to represent signals as well. This is not what DCT is based. This is not what DCT looks like, actually. But in fact, I was telling you about how you can use deep learning to find the best representation of a signal, of a group of images, and the base functions or the representation that would come out of training a big neural network on a larger amount of data would probably look like something like this. And that is a highly efficient basis to encode data. Efficient in the sense that for a given patch in your image, it would activate only a few, it would require only a few of those patches. And all the rest could be just zeros. And that's easy to transfer. Okay, so visual cortex at the back of the brain for some reason. We have, like I said, increasing as you move along the ventral stream, the visual cortex, we become less sensitive to increasingly abstract types of differences. So, for example, if you look at the red dot, look at it. Do you see any differences? Yes, but you moved away from the central dot, didn't you? No? Okay, well, sure. It's probably easier to trick your brain into not noticing that this is all completely messed up if we have a smaller screen, like set of particular conditions. But the point is, typically, you would not notice the differences here because they are so-called metamers of the ventral stream. You probably heard metamers in the context of color science, two colors that appear the same, even though they come from different spectra. But there's also metamers in the ventral stream, and that definition pertains more to texture perception. So two textures. So you can think of this patch here, this circle, this disk of pixels, as a texture, in general, like one big texture with certain characteristics. You can extract, you know, histogram or co-occurrence matrices on a number of texture attributes from this set. But our visual system, if you're focusing on the central dot, doesn't allow us to perceive the differences between. It's obviously completely messed up and a natural signal. Right? So that's because, of course, as you move away from the center of attention, your receptive field have increasingly large sizes. I'm not sure if I'm showing this here, but no, well, it's here. Although not necessarily illustrating that. But yeah, so of course you have the most sensitivity, the higher resolution at the center of your fovea, your center of attention. And your peripheral vision, like I said, is increasingly blurry. But blurry can also mean you would extract some kind of information about the texture. You'd have a very basic idea of what the texture looks like. But you would not be able to distinguish, because these attributes are so coarse, you would not be able to distinguish between people wearing a hat and whatever that is, complete mess. So that's something, of course, that can also be exploited. So if you can predict where people look at, and that is actually a pretty big challenge, though, you can save a lot of computational bandwidth. And that's used in virtual reality headsets, where you're looking at something and, well, you can know, depending on what you're looking at, but if you have like a character that will enter the room, or if you're playing a video game and you know the action seems to lead you to a certain direction, then you can sort of predict to an extent where you're going to look at like next. And that allows you to compress a lot what you're not going to look at, because otherwise it's really difficult to render high fidelity images or graphics in real time. Virtual reality. So you can remove the colors, you can make the texture really coarse, remove a lot of high frequencies. This is not necessarily to do just with high or low frequencies. It's really, if you take these representations, for example, you know, there are some notions of frequency and orientation. Orientation is pretty clear. Frequency a little bit less, but of course, you know, this is probably more lower frequency, higher frequency. But you can probably order them in terms of, you know, frequency from top left to bottom right, and orientation as you move in that direction. But there are some representations of the signal where you can actually separate this type of textures from these, and that will allow you to save computational bandwidth. So, as I mentioned, two types of visual masking. That's what the type of visual masking, of course, but provided you look at a specific point. And so low-level masking prevents or confuses the perception of differences between stimuli, even if you know where they are. So, for example, can you spot the difference between these two images? Really high frequency, really low texture going on. That's like a little spot that is different. And it actually is right there. Can you see it? This is straight one minus the other. So you might think that you see it, but okay, I'm not completely sure about these conditions, depending on where you sit in the room. You know, there's some ambient lights and but if you look at this in under controlled conditions with a given distance to the screen, and provided that we already also make an assessment of your visual acuity as well, it's very important, then most people, great majority of people, just cannot see the difference, because the information that pertains to this difference, it is encoded in our... Well, it is captured by our eyes, but it's lost as the information moves along the ventral stream. It might be present in V1, probably not. But if it is present in V1, it's definitely not in V2, even less in V4. So it's lost, and it's you can't, even if you draw attention to it, you just can't see it. You're not equipped to see that difference. High-level masking, on the other hand, and I will just give you a sec to find the difference between these two.
Trees.
Mm-hmm.
Behind.
Anyone didn't see it until I showed it? I guess I need to rethink my examples, make them a bit harder. But it's a thin line between trying to make it difficult, but at the same time, completely obvious when you see it. But there will probably be more examples, which I'm hoping will be more challenging. Anyway, so high-level masking. You don't see the difference until you know where they are. So you actually take a while to look for them, and at some point you see them, and next time you see the image, you know exactly where it is. So it might take you 5 seconds the first time, but it will take you 0 seconds the second time. So difference between low and high level masking. Okay. So here's an example of gradual change. Did you notice something while I was speaking? The color of the cactus in the center. It's changing. Now it's changing. Right? But the scene is extremely complex. Of course, you don't know where.
Okay, I'm telling you there's some difference. So is it that guy? Is it this bag? Where is the difference going?
So you would spend some time trying to find a difference. Actually, it's right in the center, and it's a pretty big color difference. Right? And you would notice it more likely if I were showing you the picture side by side. It's likely you would notice it after a while. But because the change happens gradually, and even though it's a static scene, and because I was talking at the same time, you probably didn't notice it. So imagine if it's a video, and it's not the center of attention. You can really exploit that. So here we have, it's a borderline between change blindness, because it is a change that you don't see, and inattentional blindness, because you don't see it, because you don't pay attention to it. But it is really change blindness because it's a change. So you don't encode, or you don't consciously perceive the difference that's just taking place before your eyes. It can be exploited also for compression. Did you ever see that? Different guy. The lady didn't notice. This guy is even wearing shorts. The other one was wearing jeans and a black bag. They just happened to have a white t-shirt and a hat, a cap. And that there are many experiments like this. Okay, so count the number of passes, right? Well, okay, it's a bit too late, I told you. You all noticed the gorilla, right?
Yeah.
But if I hadn't told you, well, the video starts a little bit earlier, actually, where you do a few seconds before the gorilla enters the scene. But if you ask the person to count the number of passes, their attention will be drawn to counting, and they will not notice the gorilla. 90% of the cases, or even more, people, what, there was a gorilla? Where? And now you see it again. Ah, of course. That's inattentional blindness. It's not a change, but it's just that I drew your attention to something else, and therefore you don't notice that. And that, to an extent, can also be exploited in compression, but it's much more challenging because we don't have a change. A change can be characterized as a color difference, as a texture difference, or something, you know, in terms of low-level feature, low-level image attributes. This is much more complex. And even more complex is the fact that we, in order to predict inattentional blindness, we will need to be able to predict attention very thoroughly, or at least to a pretty great extent. And at this, nowadays, we are able to predict what is called bottom-up saliency. So if something pops up, like, you know, a red dot in the middle of a blue background, it pops out. It's obvious. But that's not involving memory or attention. It's really just, it's your visual system that captures this contrast and tells you there is a contrast. It's really bottom-up. Top-down is really what's going on here. Okay, it's not like the gorilla is pink. If it were pink, it would be silent immediately. It happens to blend pretty nicely in the scene. It doesn't disturb the color gamut. It doesn't disturb anything really other than, well, it is a gorilla, I guess. So, but I mentioned this bottleneck. So what's going on is that when you look at the visual system, and here, well, I guess you saw the difference, but here around, there you just have one. So that's illustrates the concept of, you know, awareness-driven compression or consciousness-driven compression. It takes you a while to notice that there are two different types of trees, but in the end, this is just as good an image as that one. It serves the same purpose, which is none in that case, but it looks kind of the same, generally speaking. But what's going on and why? If I hadn't told you that there were two different types of trees on the left, you probably would have taken you a little while. It's because your early vision system captures a lot of information. It's limited in sense, so that's low-level masking due to some of these limitations, but it still captures colors, edges, and converts this into blobs and whatever. And then, at a later stage, something that we would call late vision, even if it's relatively vague what is called late vision, but it's just later, higher processes of the brain where we have these objects and we have a spotlight effect, which means that there's only so much we can focus our conscious attention to at a given time. The same can be said for unconscious attention as well, but that is something I would not dare to talk too much about because it's quite a relatively complex field and I don't know much about unconscious attention. But even your conscious attention, you have a bottleneck, you have so-called attention spotlight. So you can only pick a few of those high-level features, high-level attributes here, to bring to your conscious attention. So, only a few at a time. And you will pick the ones that seem the most salient, that seem the most important. And it's likely that you will stick to those. And until some point there's a click and you notice, wow, okay, there was actually two different types of trunks and bushes represented on the left here. But because of the attention spotlight, initially it was not encoded. It arrived somewhere in your visual cortex, but at some point it was just discarded because of attention. So in order to predict change blindness, and I'm just going to leave inattentional blindness on the side, in order to predict change blindness, there's been a bit of research on this. I published a couple of articles on this myself with Marius, actually. And we captured a lot of data, and we tried to find the best features to predict it. And of course, these features have to do with how complex the scene is, right? For example, that scene up there, obviously, it's not Where's Waldo, but it's a similar sort of principle. The more complex, the more difficult it is to find Waldo. You all know what Where's Waldo is, right? Yeah. So complexity of the scene is a mask in itself. It's masking the detail that we are modifying. Because it's complex. Then it depends on the change, of course, itself, the nature, location, and magnitude of the change. If it's right in the middle, it doesn't mean that it's going to be perceived, like in the example of the cactus here. But if you know where it is, if it's a change in color or texture, if it's how big is the change, what's the magnitude of the color difference, for example, that is probably, and again, there's still ongoing research on this, so in general, it's still probably a good type of features to predict the change. And by predicting the change, I mean predicting the probability to detect the change within a given time, typically 60 seconds in the experiments on change blindness. Most of the literature focuses on 60-second task, apart from some cases. And of course, and perhaps even more importantly, it depends on the person. So what did you have for breakfast? What is your mood? And how old are you? And what is your background? So for example, if I show a picture of the Eiffel Tower, maybe French people will be much more sensitive to finding changes because they're more used to seeing that picture, or a picture of a famous president of a country, which some people would know, and you know what I mean. So everybody has a different culture, a different background, so it will be more sensitive to certain kind of changes. That, of course, is really difficult to model, to include in your model, and it's very difficult to gather a lot of data from a lot of people with sufficiently diverse backgrounds. Right? It's great we have students from a lot of different countries here, but unfortunately, to predict such a complex phenomenon as change blindness, it's not really sufficient. It has been sufficient for us to prove that we can predict it, and to prove that it can be useful in image and video compression. But there's much more that needs to be done. Depends on your alertness. So if you had coffee in the morning, if you're a coffee drinker and if you're sensitive to caffeine, then you probably would be more alert to an extent. And that will make you more likely to find a change quickly, right? But not necessarily. Depends on how familiar you are with the task. If you played the Spot the Difference game like a million times last week, if I give you the Spot the Difference image today, you will probably be much more efficient than someone who had never played a game before. So we did a user study, like I said. We had about 120 observers in New Zealand and Norway, 300 scenes, and one color change per scene. The flicker paradigm means that we showed an image and then a blank screen for 80 milliseconds and another one, and it flicked like this, tuck, 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 instead of having them side by side. Of course, we had to ask if they were sensitive to epilepsy or this kind of thing, so there are some ethical considerations around this kind of research, but we didn't have any problems so far. And we collected about 10,000 detection times. And what's important is that what's some of the important results we found, and this was not a quality-oriented study, but just generally, can we predict change blindness with low-level image features? And we found that people tend to agree on what is an easy and hard case, but what's in between, there's a lot of disagreement, and that's characterized by the inter-observer variability. These are in seconds, so the detection time, how long it takes you to find a change in a not-so-easy and not-so-hard case will vary a lot in this room. If we pick an easy case, you will all find it quickly. A hard case, maybe none of you will find it. So, then in order to, like I said, we're trying to predict change blindness, so we need to find out what it is that we are predicting, actually. And we decided to predict not the average detection time, because by looking at the distribution of detection times for different scenes, it's not just randomly selected scenes, well, we see that the distribution is not Gaussian. So, for example, if you take the yellow line here, it shows you that most people for scene 23 will take about 15 seconds to detect the change. But there's a significant amount of people who would still take up to 40 seconds. And for some reason, there's just a couple of people who would not notice it at all. Right? So this is not Gaussian. So we cannot take the mean as a good representative of this distribution. And it's the same for the other distribution. It tends to be more, it's not Poisson, it's really hard to say what it is exactly. It's non-Gaussian. So instead of taking the mean, we decided to take the mode of detection time, the peak, the top of the curve. For example, for scene 23, it was about 15 seconds. For scene 10, the blue line here was about 37 seconds or something else. So this is the number we tried to predict. And we used different features. So we tried different features. We used, for example, the magnitude of the change, so the color difference in a extension of C-Lab, a color space that's a little bit more perceptually uniform and meaningful than C-Lab, but basically C-Lab and on steroid. And we calculated the color difference in that space, and we call this the change magnitude. Like I said, we focused only on color differences in that experiment. We looked at the saliency imbalance, so calculating the saliency map made of the original image of the, well, of the two images, and seeing if there's a significant difference, like something that pops out in one and not in the other, like using bottom-up salience. And that's what another attribute. And the last attribute was to basically how many examples have you seen up to that one. The more examples you've seen before, the faster you will be at, the more efficient you will be at finding the change. And using these three attributes, and just to motivate the fact that, okay, so that these are the position in sequence. So you know, you start first image, and after 100 image, well, the experiment ends, and you have become much more efficient. It takes you much less time. Of course, it varies a lot because the sequence was randomized, completely randomized. But so this is just a Monte Carlo-based regression with some uncertainty that was noted by the dotted lines here. But it basically said that there's a downward trend. And on average, we can say that after each trial, you become more efficient by about 80 milliseconds. So experience has an effect. And then we went on and tried to prove that it worked in the context of image quality. And we did a bunch of experiments. The typical context for image quality assessment is that you show two pictures side by side, and then you ask what's the scale, on a scale from 1 to 5, 1 to 10, whatever. Or you just show one image, and what is the quality of that image? In one case, it's full reference or image fidelity, and in other case, it's no reference. But this is all about full reference case. So we showed two images side by side. We asked people to analyze them, click on done, and once they were done, which one had the highest quality? Had to click on left or right, or I don't know. And then we did exactly the same thing, but showing the pictures one after the other. So that forced people to rely much more on their short-term memory. And so we found that there was some significant differences between these two, basically. Another experiment we did is that we showed people the image pairs first, and then we showed them where the differences were by showing the picture and then the other without interval between, so the difference popped out. That was a stage we called priming. We were telling people where the differences are in case they hadn't seen it in the first place. And then we did a second comparison, and it turns out people were much harsher in their ratings in the second comparison because they were able to notice compression artifacts, or in that case we looked also at gamut mapping artifacts, different types of noise as well, not artifacts, etc. So that's another evidence that there is some change blindness going on here. Like, until you notice where the change is, you tend to be a little bit more lenient in your quality assessment. And yet another experiment we did is we placed an artifact in an image. Right. So we took a pristine image, compressed one. And then we picked one location randomly, and we took the pixel from the compressed image and we hid them in the pristine image so as to obtain a hybrid one. And so this region here actually is made of pixels from the compressed image. And then we asked people to find this. And basically it was hard in some cases, but easy in others, and we found out what predicts best this difficulty of finding the artifact based on location, magnitude, and so on. It was best predicted by features from an image difference metric, I won't go into the detail of this. This one is interesting. Salience imbalance. The fact that something pops out in an image and not necessarily in the other, regardless of which one is the original. But if there's a difference in what pops out, then, well, you will be more likely to find it. So if you want to compress an image by exploiting change blindness, you want to make sure the saliency map before and after the change are the same. And then we've also found some deep features on a, I think it was VGG16 architecture trained on ImageNet, so typical type of image features we're predicting. And lastly, I want to show you an example also of a study we made where we compressed the background of an image by reducing its chromaticity. And because it was done gradually, just like in the example of the cactus, I don't have a video, so unexpected, but the top one is basically the start of the video, and after 5-6 seconds, we end up with this. And at the end of the video, the background is completely gray. And we found that in most cases, people were not able to notice it. And whereas if we show them the beginning frame and the last frame, they would notice the difference, and it would indeed say that there's a much lower quality in the end of the picture. But if this quality change happens gradually, they don't see it. Okay, well, and another area where this can be used as well is in photographics. You can reduce the rendering quality of your scene and save a lot of computational bandwidth. Those of you who are in photographics with me, you know that bandwidth is really key when it comes to photographics. It's important to save as much of it as possible. And you can remove some texture on the floor, for example, some shadows on the floor without people noticing necessarily. So here you notice because you have time to see the scene is dynamic. You wouldn't notice. Most people wouldn't notice. And that can save a lot of bandwidth on account of visual change blindness. That's it for me. And if you have any questions or any comments or ideas for projects or whatever along those lines, you know where to find me. Okay? Thanks for your attention. See you on Thursday. Tomorrow.
Whenever I'm in it, it goes back, for example, like I لازم تلم هلا نسوها.
أبي أهر هذي أهر كهذي متوشة بك. بس بس كبر الطاولة. بيتكم بيكون كبر. بيكون كبر تلدة. أنت نو بس. داريا. Hasan look there in. Hasan.
Mari.
Är det en god not heter den du brukar? Nej, not. Vad du brukar?
En
smart notebook, ja.
Smart.
Vi kan köra elektro, visst vi vill. Hasan, bara öppna Blackboard. Vi kan, man kan öppna Можете? Nej, jag som det är, han det sätter nu med den. Det trodde han hvis jeg laster den ned, den lagres i brukeren eller lagres i PC-en?
Brukeren.
Dis PC står der.
Vi bør slette den når vi er ferdig. Hvem retter den, Erik? Erik ut til Erik 2.
Hva sier?
Sinretter, da. Han gjør det. Studasene som retter, da.
Only you.
Det god pen?
Ja. Hvordan hva var funksjonen på den knappen? Kan man ikke slette når man holder på den?
Til sikkerheten må ta viskere. Du hørte ditt teksten, du må slette den. Delete på tastaturet.
Slette.
Der, ja.
Og så må du slette ditt tekst inn. Nei, vent.
Men